I'm Dave. I play drums and shout a whole lot in Japandroids from Vancouver, BC, Canada. Yeah, we kind of started it as, you know, it's just like a, you know, one of those fun bands that you start out when you don't really know what the hell you're doing. Brian and I were both, Brian had just graduated from university and I was just wrapping up a university, and there was kind of a whole slew of our friends who are around the same age who all, right around that time, were all playing different bands together. So one of those bands, amongst others, was Japandroids. So yeah, it just started out kind of as something, you know, fun. Brian knew how to play guitar pretty well by then, but I didn't really know how to play drums much at all. I was pretty much a novice still at that time. So yeah, it was just something that we were kind of doing for fun, and then we became increasingly obsessed with that band as time went on, and then it kind of became our whole lives pretty soon after we started, and then continues to dominate every aspect of our life to this day.
Okay, so with your lineup, I mean, it's quite a minimalist lineup. You've got a guitarist, drummer, both of you sing or shout. Uh-huh. I was just wondering, was that kind of out of necessity, or was that a kind of conscious decision that you made, and kind of how you came to being just a two-piece?
I mean, I think certainly a lot of it had to do with necessity. I don't think we really felt that much pressure to have more members. I think, you know, at that time, you know, there were already quite a few really popular bands that I don't know if they were really direct influences on us, you know, sonically. But, you know, when you see bands like Death From Above or White Stripes or No Age, you know, you see people, you know, writing really great songs and performing them just as a two-piece, you know, you don't feel that need that you need more instruments. And I think the only place we really thought we were lacking in the beginning was with vocals. You know, I think that was the one piece of the puzzle that we thought was missing. And we did shop around a bit trying to find someone to sing, you know, to have kind of more of like a yeah, yeah, yeah style set up, you know, where there's somebody playing guitar, there's somebody playing drums, and then there's one person, and their whole job is just to sing. You know, neither of us really had much confidence in ourselves as singers, you know, because we pretty accurately, you know, could see that neither of us were particularly talented singers. But after a while, you know, you just get impatient, and you just want to start playing shows and start showing off the songs that you've written. So after a while, once we couldn't find, you know, a good singer, we just decided to take that job on ourselves, you know, somewhat begrudgingly.
So, I mean, I read that you, you know, you kind of found it quite difficult to, I suppose, get into the scene in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And you kind of took it on yourself and took a kind of DIY, almost punk route mm-hmm. into getting noticed. I mean, I was wondering if you could kind of expand on that a little bit and tell me kind of how that started.
Yeah, I mean, again, that was just something we did out of necessity, you know. I mean, there's not, you know, Vancouver is still a bit of a musical hinterland, you know. It's not somewhere that's really famous for being like a breeding ground for the next hot new band, you know. There are some bands, you know, like us, obviously, that have managed to, you know, tour all over the place and get some recognition while still being based in Vancouver, but it's not a place where, you know, you release, you know, a demo and then you're going to get snapped up by a label and a booking agent and all kinds of things like that. So, you know, if we wanted to play shows, we had to book them ourselves. So that's what we did, you know. And I think to some extent we also kind of existed outside of any specific musical community in Vancouver. It's a bit fractured there, I think, between, you know, bands that are more straightforward rock bands that are more part of the noise or punk scenes, bands that are, you know, playing, I don't know, indie or rock versus, you know, heavy rock versus whatever. So, you know, we kind of existed in a bit of a weird world because we're not really a straightforward rock band. We're not really a punk band. We're not really a garage rock band. We're kind of just something somewhere in between all of those. So the freedom that we had that was really fun was getting to, you know, set up our own bills, because we would usually contact venues directly, set up our own shows, and then set up the bill, make posters for it, promote the shows ourselves. So the cool thing about that was we could kind of cherry pick the bands we liked, you know, from all the different scenes and kind of put together some pretty eclectic lineups, because you definitely in Vancouver, you saw a lot of the time, a lot of the same bands playing together month after month, week after week for years on end, you know, and so that was the cool thing about that, was we had a bit more freedom because we weren't trying to really play in any scene, you know. That hurt us, but it helped us in some ways too, I suppose. I think having that kind of DIY aesthetic helped us handle all the things that's come since then a lot better than many other bands, because we got used to just controlling so much of what the band does on our own. So once you start getting those people who are out there who want to help you, you know, you can allow them to help you but still maintain your identity and still control, you know, what your band does and what you're willing to do and not willing to do in order to become successful.
So I suppose then you've kind of come from this, as you describe it, as a kind of musical hinterland. And I was just wondering, have you kind of been back? And if so, what's the kind of reception you get now? How do you find that?
I think, you know, one of the things I really like about Vancouver personally is the fact that I don't feel like it's changed very much the way that people, you know, talk to me. Or interact with me now that I'm in some, like, quote unquote, you know, like, popular band. You know, I mean I know most of the people in the music scene from back in the you know, a few years ago before we were, you know, when Japandroids didn't mean shit, you know. So you know, I don't think that people really treat me any differently now, and I think for the most part people are really supportive and happy that, you know, we've managed to kind of escape Vancouver and get a name for ourselves. But at the same time, it's not like we come back and we're like these hometown heroes, and if I walk down the street, everybody's going to know who I am. People have no idea who I am, who don't know me personally, which is nice. You know, it's a weird... It's obviously very flattering when you know, for example, tonight, I'm sure if I'm walking around watching Paws play, who are a great band, by the way, who are playing the show with us, who we've toured with before, you know, if I'm going to be out there watching them play, a bunch of people are going to come up to me and say, hey, I like your band, and blah, 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 and I'm glad you guys are playing in Leeds, which is awesome. But truth be told, that stuff does still make me kind of uncomfortable, and it's nice to kind of slip back in, and you know, in many ways, when I go back to Vancouver, it feels like none of this life exists, you know, and I'm kind of back to just being a regular person in Vancouver and not in this weird fantasy land that you can exist in when you play in a professional rock band.
So, I mean, you kind of touched on it earlier. You mentioned maybe not a sonic influence as such, but, you know, people like Death From Above. And I was just wondering, you know, what kind of influences would you cite, and have those kind of evolved and changed over time?
I think to some extent, you know, I think there are some people who are very good at very consciously seeing a band and then being like, I am going to sound like that band. My band is going to sound like that band. I love Joy Division. I'm going to make a band that sounds just like Joy Division, except, you know, we're going to exist 30 years later or whatever. More than 30 years later, I guess, no. You know, and I think it's a good thing that Brian and I are not very good at that. You know, I think we had a certain idea about the kind of sound we were going to have, and I don't think we necessarily sound that way. You know, I think we, you know, we had a list of bands we wanted to sound like, you know, and to some extent, maybe we've cherry-picked some things and stolen some things from them, but at the same time, as time goes on, I think we've kind of just developed our own voice more and more, and the more you play with somebody, the more you understand where they're going with an idea, and the more you can kind of allow your voice to come through naturally, rather than trying to kind of fight whatever's coming naturally for you and try and have an idea for what you should sound like. So, I mean, you know, when we started out, you know, we talked a lot about the Sonics, which we've mentioned lots in interviews. We certainly have ripped off the Constantines, who are, you know, are still one of our all-time favorite bands and are criminally underappreciated, and are no longer around making music, which is sad. You know, but then, you know, other bands I don't think we really ended up sounding much like at all. You know, like, we talked about Wire a lot. We talked about, you know, McCluskey a lot, and Yeah Yeah Yeahs a lot, you know. But I don't think we really sound like those bands very much, you know. Maybe on some level, you know. But I think, you know, luckily for us, we're just not that good at ripping off other bands.
So, I mean that's kind of reminding me, you've done some covers mm-hmm. over your time. I mean, one of them is a McCluskey track, isn't it? And you've also done PJ Harvey, which is quite an interesting... I mean, what other covers have you done, and I suppose what kind of covers are you hoping to do in the future?
I think we've been pretty picky about what we choose to cover. And the main criterion are basically we want to choose a band that we think not enough people know about, for the most part, or certainly not people who necessarily listen to our band would know about. I mean, it's not like, you know, I don't think any of the bands we've chosen to cover really need our help or anything like that, but we do like to try and spread the gospel about some of those bands in whatever way we can. You know, and then the other big thing is trying to choose music that hasn't been covered to death, you know, so that we can kind of bring our own identity to it, and it can kind of become something that's associated with our band, you know, almost as much as it's associated with the band that first played it. So, you know, songs like, I feel like our cover of To Hell With Good Intentions by McCluskey, you know, that was a staple of our set for like 5 years almost, you know, we'd play that most nights, you know, and we don't play it as good as McCluskey did or as Future of the Left play it, but, you know, at the same time, we kind of were able to, you know, put our own kind of identity on that song and do it our way, and it became this thing that people would, you know, look forward, hopefully, to seeing us do live and enjoy hearing. You know, it's the same thing with, you know, picking For the Love of Ivy by the Gun Club. I mean, you know, we are not the Gun Club. We are not in the same league as the Gun Club. But at the same time, it's been really fun to play that song. And I feel like we've been able to put our own kind of stamp on it. And it's become this cover that, you know, people, you know, as time goes on, you know, it's becoming part of, you know, it's a Japandroid song to a large extent for a lot of people out there, which is really cool, you know. It's a lot harder to do that with some songs that have, you know, been covered to death over the years, you know. That's a big reason why we don't cover a band like the Sonics, you know, because we love the Sonics, but I mean, they've been covered a lot, you know, and it would be a lot... You wouldn't feel like you're really adding anything by covering that, because you'd just be another band covering the Sonics for the 50 millionth time, you know? So.
Cool. So, I mean, in 2009, I think it was, you had a bit of a crisis point as a band. And I've read in places that you kind of marketed the fact that you were doing your last gig, that you were going to be splitting up.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of changed, and why did you kind of carry on?
That crisis point was in 2008, and basically it just, you know, like I said, we'd been setting up our own shows and kind of doing everything ourselves for a while by that point, you know. That was the third full year of basically setting up every show for ourselves, you know, releasing, we'd released two EPs at that time on our own. With no help, and we were about to release Post Nothing on our own again, you know, and it just felt like, the powers that be were telling us that it wasn't going to happen for this band, you know, you know, like I said with Vancouver, you know, it's a very common thing, for bands to not exist for all that long in Vancouver, you know, there's a lot of great bands in Vancouver that just they played a million shows in Vancouver, maybe went on one tour that totally bombed across Canada, or maybe went on one tour that totally bombed down the West Coast, and then just started to get frustrated and kind of bored with playing to the same group of people, you know, once a month or whatever, and broke up, started other bands, and kept going, and it's a very Vancouver thing, I think, for very talented people to constantly be changing bands. I mean, most of my friends have played in, like, you know, 5 or 6 bands over the course of time that Japandroids have existed. You know, it's pretty rare that bands last that long in Vancouver. So it wasn't really that weird, you know. I mean, it sounds weird now because obviously, like, we've come all this way now, and you know, you look back and you're like, you were about to break up. You guys are total morons. What's wrong with you? But you know, at the time, that was very much the culture in Vancouver. Was you kind of put out a couple records, do your thing for a bit, and then you get bored playing the same club, you know, and maybe you'll play the same club over and over again with a different band to kind of make it more interesting for yourself. So, you know, basically what happened was, you know, we'd been waiting to tour and hoping that somebody would come along and kind of save us. You know, we'd mailed out our EPs to every label we could think of, every kind of, you know, blog and website we could think of, college radio stations all over North America, you know, all that kind of stuff. We'd done that on our own, you know, so we didn't have a publicist or a label to help us with any of that stuff, you know, but it just felt like we're just sending all this music out into the ether and nobody's really responding, so it doesn't seem like much is going to happen, so maybe we should try something different. And then basically right as we had kind of decided that, and basically had a list of shows that we were going to still play and then kind of kill things after that, was right when some people started to take interest. You know, a label called Unfamiliar Records based in Toronto wanted to put the record out. So we had to, so then we stopped with the whole self-release thing, you know. And then all of a sudden we started getting a couple good reviews in Toronto. And then later, you know, we get a MySpace message. Remember MySpace? I guess it's trying to come back. But anyways, we get a MySpace message from a journalist at Pitchfork saying, "Hey, I'm so-and-so from Pitchfork. We're thinking about posting a track. Is that okay with you?" Or something like that. And we're like, well, fuck, of course. Of course that's all right with us. You know, so all of a sudden, you know, it just as things were winding down and it felt like we'd kind of, well, you know, thrown in the towel, all of a sudden things started to kind of pick up, and naturally we were very curious about it. So we just said, well, let's, you know, see where this goes. I mean, we both want to tour, we both want to play shows. So we'd love to have a label put our record out. I mean, that was, you know, even a label like Unfamiliar, which is a very small label, doing a 500 copy run on, of our record on vinyl. That was amazing, you know. That was so huge for us. I mean, that was so exciting. So obviously, once we got an opportunity to do that, we were like, sure, let's do it. And I mean, we've kind of existed in that way ever since, you know, basically being on borrowed time and kind of seeing what's going to happen next. And it's now been 5 years almost, you know, since all that stuff happened, which is crazy to think about. Wow.
So, I mean, Going back to the, I suppose, the release of Post Nothing, and I suppose going beyond that, you I find it interesting that you released quite a few singles that weren't on the album. I mean, again, was that something out of necessity, or was that just to kind of taking the kind of Joy Division New Order approach of keeping the singles and albums separate? Or?
I mean, I think it was a bit of both. You know, we had some songs that just didn't quite make the cut for Post Nothing, and then, you know, we decided to put Post Nothing out as an 8-song record, and then once we started getting a label, you know, behind us, or at first we had two labels behind us, you know, all of a sudden we just had that, frankly, we had money, you know, to record with, because we just ran out of money with Post Nothing. We ran out of time and ran out of money. So all of a sudden we had a label that was willing to put out stuff for us and was also willing to help, like, pay for recording. And we had these little bits and pieces of songs that we still wanted to finish off. And it felt like, you know, waiting a couple of years, you know, for the next record to come out seemed crazy. So, you know, and I think we also felt a bit of pressure to, like, expand on our catalog because we started touring so heavily. You know, we wanted to have more songs to play for people. So, you know, it was kind of a mix of a bunch of different things. You know, we thought singles were cool, but we also just had these songs that we wanted to get out there sooner than having to wait, you know, until we got around to making another full-length record. So that's kind of where that came from. And then obviously the cover thing came about from that too, you know, because we thought it was a cool idea to do an A-side original and then a B-side cover and kind of expand on the different covers that we do. Which, yeah, so it was just kind of a different, I guess it was just a mix of different things that all kind of aligned to have it make a lot of sense to do.
Yeah, okay. So with moving on then to Celebration Rock, that's come out about a year ago now, and you told me before the interview that you've kind of been touring that since then. And to me, it struck me as an album that was a bit more kind of refined and a bit more mature almost than Post Nothing. Uh-huh. I was wondering if you could just kind of tell me, I suppose, what you felt were the kind of key differences in recording that album, and I suppose how the evolution came about. Was it a conscious thing or just kind of natural progression, I suppose?
I think if you listen to all of our recordings going back to the first two EPs that we put out before Post Nothing, I think you can see a pretty clear evolution. I mean, I don't think we made these huge jumps from one record to the next or one recording to the next, but you just can tell that we're getting a little better at what we do. And I think with Celebration Rock, you know, that was our first record that we made as like a quote-unquote professional band. You know, a lot had changed since we recorded Post Nothing. You know, we'd been on the road for basically a year and a half straight promoting Post Nothing. And it just improved a lot as musicians, you know. And I think quite naturally, we just had better ideas about the kind of band we wanted to be and the kind of songs we wanted to write. And part of that came from, a lot of that came from touring, you know, just playing your songs every day. And also, you know, gauging crowds and figuring out what, you know, where does it lag in the set? What are the songs the crowd responds to? What are the songs that are most fun for us to play, you know, for the 200 millionth time in a row? You know, so there, I think just a lot more thought was put into Celebration Rock, because it wasn't just a bunch of songs we'd kind of worked on for a while and were excited about. It was like, it was a much more conscious decision to make a record, you know, make a full-length album and figure out how do these songs fit together and what are we missing, you know, and what else do we need to put on this record to make it feel complete, you know, a lot of questions like that. You know, it was recorded in the same studio with the same engineer. So on paper, you know, it's a very similar process. You know, it was just drums, guitar, and us singing with Jesse behind the boards at the same studio we did Post Nothing. But at the same, other than that, you know, everything was so different. You know, our like where we were at, you know, mentally was so different. You know, we just, you know, changed a lot as people and you know, had just kind of grown into becoming, you know, more quote-unquote professional musicians, you know, where this wasn't something we were doing for fun on the weekends anymore. You know, this was, and not to say that it was something we just did for fun on the weekends, but it had become something that it could completely, you know, completely dominated our lives. And so, you know, this band is the first thing I think about when I wake up and the last thing I think about when I go to bed, you know, and it's been like that for many years now. So, you know, I think we saw some pretty clear areas to improve upon. We thought we were better musicians, really wanted to push ourselves musically. And you know, I think we did things musically that we couldn't have done on the last record. You know, I don't think I would have ever wanted to play a drum solo on Post Nothing. You know, I didn't really want to play a drum solo on this record either, but I felt at least I could do it. If I worked hard enough, it could get done. You know, and I think there's a lot of things Brian did guitar-wise that were really challenging to him that he wouldn't have physically been able to do, you know, back when we were recording Post Nothing, because we're just better musicians now. But I think beyond all that, because this is a very long-winded answer, but beyond all that, I think the biggest place where we really improved was with vocals, you know. I think Brian specifically really embrace being a lead singer on this record, and I think it's the first record where he's really done that, where he's, you know, the vocals haven't been an afterthought for us, where we're trying to scramble to figure out what to sing and, you know, how to sing over an instrumental that we slaved away on for a long time. This is the first time we really, you know, a lot of the times the vocal melodies would come first or certain lines would come first, and Brian really worked hard to you know, really push himself as a lyricist, you know, and I think the lyrics on this record are just significantly better and substantial compared to Post Nothing. And I think that's the really clear improvement to me on this record. You know, I just feel like we're saying something, you know, on this record a lot more than we were on a lot of songs in Post Nothing. You know, some songs in Post Nothing have like know, a total of about 15 words in them, you know, whereas these have, you know, paragraphs of lyrics. So I think that's a really big area of improvement for our band.
So I suppose then, I mean, that kind of leads on to a question I was going to ask, was about the, again, that kind of minimalist thing with the lyrics on Post Nothing. I mean, why was that? I mean, was that, again, out of necessity because you weren't that good at writing lyrics, or was it just a kind of statement that you're trying to make?
I mean, I think we prescribe to like the idea that less is more, and that if you can't write very strong lyrics, you shouldn't write more of them. I think that's a main part of where it came from. I think, you know, Post Nothing was certainly, we were a little more conscious of what we were singing about than on earlier recordings, where, you know, literally we would be writing lyrics after we'd already recorded the bed tracks just so we could record a vocal. You know, that's weird. You know, when we recorded those EPs, like some of those songs, we literally had to write the lyrics like in the studio that day. And it wasn't that bad at Post Nothing. We did take more time to try and write, but, I think we just felt that the instruments were the strongest part of the band, so it's better to let them shine rather than trying to sing all over it and kind of, you know, kill a good instrumental with some mediocre lyrics and mediocre singing. Whereas by the time we got around to Celebration Rock, I think we just had a bit more confidence in ourselves as singers. So it wasn't something you were trying to bury in the mix and, you know, bathe in a blanket of distortion. It was something you were a bit more proud of and wanted to have up front and center because you felt like you were saying something.
So, I mean, you've got a reputation for being a kind of very energetic and exciting live outfit. And, you know, you've obviously toured a lot. And I was just wondering, what have been the kind of strangest or most surreal moments you've had while on tour?
Strangest or most surreal... I mean, I think it's a weird thing. I mean, I think when you tour as much as we do, you know, this becomes your normal life way more than being at home. When I'm home, I don't know what the hell to do with myself most days because I'm just so used to constantly being on the move and constantly playing shows. You know, but there's certainly, there's certainly been a lot of very surreal moments, especially if you really stop to think about what's going on and where you are, you know. There's been plenty of overly energetic and overly enthusiastic fans out there. This one kid, when we played in Sydney, he ran from backstage and tried to clear, it was a festival stage, so there's a huge gap between the stage and the audience, and the guy tried to clear the gap, and he did not make it. He landed so hard, right on the barrier, in the middle of his song, but luckily, I think he had a few beverages, so his body kind of flopped more than, like, bracing itself when it, you know, smacked on this, you know, steel barrier. So he popped right back up, and he was good, and then he jumped into the crowd, and off he went. There's been some weird moments like that where just, it's just seeing the reaction of audiences and seeing it grow with this record has been really pretty amazing. I mean, now, you know, most shows now, like, we don't even play a note, and people are already losing their fucking minds, you know, because I think they just know that that's the kind of show we're going to play, so... You know, they're just ready for it now, you know. So, I mean, and that goes everywhere, you know. I mean, some of our craziest shows have been in really far-flung, you know, exotic places, like all over Eastern Europe. The crowds are totally fucking insane. People are, like, running up, jumping on stage, singing along with every song. Our gear is getting, like, bashed around because it's just this sea of bodies, you know, packed in this sweaty little club. You know, there's been all kinds of amazing moments with different audiences, you know, and it takes a second sometimes to clue into the fact that, like, wait a second, I'm playing in Poznan, Poland right now, and people are losing their fucking minds, you know, and half these people, you know, can barely even speak English, you know, and we can't speak a word of Polish, obviously. And then we're communicating with these people on this super intense level and sharing this amazing moment. You know, we've had lots of experiences like that where you kind of have to check yourself, because you're like, oh, this, yeah, it's, this, that was a fun.